Hello, and welcome to Humans of Magic. My guest this week is Allison Lourdes. Allison is a creative writer and world builder for Magic the Gathering. She's written some iconic stories like the Ixalan series with Jace and Vraska. She also helped develop the backstory for Tomic Vrona. And she wrote the recent epilogues for the Outlaws of Thunder Junction. During her time at Wizards of the Coast, Allison also served as the creative lead for Baldur's Gate 3. She's currently the narrative director for Destiny 2. In true Humans of Magic fashion, we're looking at Allison with a wide-angle lens, starting with her roots in comedy and improv. Then we explore how Allison started working in the games industry, her creative writing method, and even get into her obsession with shows like Lost. Enjoy. For those who are listening to this interview, they may know your work best from your magic stories and story writing and storytelling and narrative around Magic the Gathering. But I feel like it would be amiss if we didn't talk about something that's very instrumental to who you are and your identity. So tell me about how you got started with comedy and improv.
I was 17 or 18 when I was still in high school, and I was definitely a theater kid when I was in high school. That should not come as a surprise at all. But me and my team were on like traveling to like this big theater event that was happening across the state, and we went to this university called the Western Washington University, and we got to see this team perform of comedians. And little 18-year-old Allison watching actual like improv, like I saw on Whose Line Is It Anyway, being done like in front of me, it was a life-changing moment of I need to go here and I need to do this. This looks like the most fun a person can have. Yes, I'm on board. And sure enough, I graduated from high school. I went to Western, and it was like 3 days before classes began that I went and like hunted down the club at their little table during the big student intro session. And I found them and said, like, I want to join. What do I need to do? And that honestly started the rest of my career, was learning how not only to play pretend and tell jokes and tell stories, but also getting the most active education in how to tell a story for an audience, not just for yourself. And there is no better teacher than performing improv. So that's how it started. And I've been performing on and off ever since then. My highlight of my college career was when our team won the National College Improv Tournament. We were the number one team out of 112 or something like that. And we were the first team outside of Illinois to ever win. And it was like winning the lottery. We were just so excited and so stoked. But yeah, it's wild that something as silly as like getting on stage with my friends and just telling stories is something that is such a part of who I am that you can't really take it out.
I feel like there's a little backstory even that leads into it. Is there something about your childhood before you were 17 that made you particularly adept at being on the stage? Like, were there signs of that, you know, with younger Allison before all that?
I was so shy as a kid, actually. I was the kid who was always very afraid to get out in front of people and very afraid to kind of like speak up. I really was a quiet kid in the family growing up. And it really wasn't until I started trying to do sports in like middle and high school. My dad was an athlete. And so the assumption was like, okay, Allison, this is what you're going to go do too. And I tried doing cross country and track. But I have scoliosis. That's how I found out. I had this horrible incident with my back, and suddenly I couldn't run anymore. And so I was looking through the list of activities like, okay, what do I do? And theater felt like the most fun thing to try out. And for a quiet little shy kid like me, it was an opportunity and like kind of permission, I guess, to try getting out there and putting my face out there and making something for somebody else.
Right. It was kind of a way to, I don't know what's the right word. Like there's, it's like you find there's a construct, like there's a way for you to channel your outgoingness or as you said, permission to mm-hmm. perform or to speak even, right?
Yeah, and that's, this is getting super duper broad and far away from the question, but like that permission is what stories are in general. Like stories are permission for you to access those really big emotions that we can't touch in everyday life. Like it's permission for you over your lunch break to read something that makes you feel the kind of feeling that you feel exactly twice in your life. Like just for a little bit, just where it's safe. And then you can go back to your everyday life and you can do your day and you don't have to be in that emotional space anymore. You can do your own thing. But that magic of like giving myself permission to get up on stage and be someone who I never thought I could be, or giving an audience permission to experience something that they never would have a chance to is really magical.
So what was the earliest thing that you could remember where you could feel some sort of connection that you're making with the audience?
Oh man, I used to draw a lot as a kid. When I was that shy kid, I really thought that I was going to be like an animator or an artist growing up. I was always doodling in my notebook. And I remember that sensation of like being in middle school and like the other kids figuring out that you are the kid that can draw. Like that moment of someone coming to you.
Superpower unlocked, right?
It is, yes. Yeah. And so that even just like that one kid coming over and saying, "Can you draw a hot dog riding a skateboard?" And I'm like, yes, yes, I can. I am important now. I will draw you this hot dog riding escape.
I am the person for that, yes.
Exactly, yeah.
So that was definitely the first taste. And going back to...
It feels great, yeah.
Yeah, going back to the improv experience, like what was that learning curve like initially of trying to do that?
Oh, brutal. It's the most humiliating thing in the world. There's a reason why improv has a reputation for being cringy and difficult to watch, because most of the time it super is. It's a lot of people who don't know what they're doing, just kind of making something up and trying to make people laugh. And so the process of learning how to do that, it requires failure. It requires constant failure of getting up there, failing on purpose, and coming back and asking yourself, okay, what did I learn? Which is a wonderful way to move past the ego of, well, it's me, and so if I'm perfect, then I'm going to be fine and no one will ever critique me. Doing something that invites critique and invites self-critique is scary and dangerous. So the process of learning is really hard. But at the same time, the reason why I love doing improv more than, say, like stand-up, for example, stand-up is very solitary. With improv, you have to have people. You have to have a group of people who not only like have your back, but are there to help you if something goes wrong. And so like getting that taste of being able to create and make something and knowing that if I screw up, there's going to be four people who instantly swoop in to come help me is a really wonderful feeling that I never really had before trying that art form out. And as I kept doing it and learned that eventually, like, not all improv is funny. Like, sometimes you can do very serious stuff with it. I really fell in love with that kind of thing. In my years since I moved to Seattle, the kind of performance that I've been really drawn to are the kinds that, to an audience, will not look like there wasn't a script. Like hour and a half long plays with like,
so it feels like it was scripted, but it
sure does, but it's not. And every single night is different. It's one of the hardest forms of storytelling, but also one of the most satisfying when everything clicks together. There's no magic like the magic of two people who had no plans going into this, who managed to make like one moment of magic happen.
Right. As someone who doesn't do improv or stand up, but is a fan of these things.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I love doing Humans of Magic is because there's a kind of way to get behind the scenes with people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always feel like when you have to be like, what's the word kids use these days? Like you have to be built a certain way or built different to do comedy or improv. Because to me, it almost feels like you have to be a glutton for punishment. It's almost like, in a way, it's a little bit like being a magic player. Like you have to be willing to fail a lot.
Yes.
And have to deal with unpleasantness on a regular basis. And you have to almost like welcome that into yourself. And then it feels bad and then good for a second, and then you want to go back and feel bad again. Like, so what's that about? Like, what's going on with you when you do
Honestly,
it?
there's kind of like a step on me, mommy, like kind of like feel to it.
I
I'm
didn't want
just
to say
like
that, but that's kind of how I feel sometimes as an audience member. Like,
it
I'm sometimes, you know, this is like sometimes I feel even bad on behalf of the performers when they're bombing or
Oh,
something, you know?
totally, totally. Yeah, no, I think that element of like not just like being comfortable with failure, but embracing failure. Because like
Yes.
when you embrace failure, that allows those moments where everything is perfect to feel even more special. Like I can't earn those moments of magic without having gone through that process of failing and failing and failing first. And then if you do it enough times, weird, you start failing less and you start finding the magic more. So like just having that courage to get up again and again and knowing that you have a bunch of people who have your back makes it so much better. It's such an enriching way of telling stories and a way of moving through the world. I would rather be someone who embraces failure than someone who's terrified of it.
It's often said, I think, by the comedians themselves. Like I think I've heard, like, Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle say that, everyone bombs, right? So, but are there improv professionals or
There are.
improvisers that seem to be a little bit more like naturals? Like they're very
Oh,
unlikely
yeah.
to mess up, or they're just pretty good on day one?
It's no, it's the ones who've been doing it for the longest are the
Okay,
ones who
it's
you can.
experience-based.
It's all experience. I've known a couple of people who take to it pretty easily, but there's some things that you're just not going to be able to know until you've done it for years. Something that we say all the time when teaching people how to do it is there's this kind of like telepathy that happens after you've been doing it long enough, and especially with the same people. So you get to know them, they get to know you. I can be out on stage and know without a doubt that my buddy Alicia is going to come out and have a great supporting line in like 5 seconds.
Oh, that they know
Like,
how to complete your sentences
yes,
almost.
exactly. Yeah, there's this really cool, like almost like psychic connection once you've been doing it long enough with somebody. But you don't get to that stage until you've messed up enough times with enough people. So yeah, it's I don't know. I think with all like skills, right? It's practice and failure are the teachers that tell you what to do next.
Tell me also about how you get the ability or develop the ability to read the room, to feed off of the audience.
Oh, improv is all listening. That's also like thing number two that you learn when doing it. It's less about getting out there and having the funny joke, and it's all about listening to what everyone else is doing on stage and listening to what the audience is doing. In like the early years of performing, it's really easy to just get in your own head and just like focus on you and what I'm doing, and here's my lines, here's how I'm doing an awesome job.
Right.
But it takes
Like most things in
experience.
life, honestly.
Exactly,
It's all about
yeah.
me, right?
Exactly. But like the hard part and the important part is learning how to like listen in between for like how much are they moving? How much are they laughing? What are they laughing at? And why do I think they're laughing at it? Usually, in like a long performance of unscripted theater, there'll be a moment where the performers get to go backstage and chat about what's going on. And every now and then someone will be like, "This audience loves fart jokes." Or I think this audience really likes the heady, crunchy, smart people stuff. Let's lean into that. So like being able to like listen for what they want and tell what they don't know they want yet is it's a skill that's kind of hard to define, but also really important, especially when doing that really long form storytelling. Ultimately, audiences just want to feel smart. Everybody just wants to feel like they're smart. And so one fun trick is just knowing how to reward them for paying attention.
What you said just now about audiences want to feel smart, I feel like that's almost like a thing in general on the internet as well, right? Because, and I'll explain what I mean by that. I feel
Please.
like oftentimes things you do on the internet get engagement when people feel like I like this thing or I'm retweeting it because I identify with it, and if I retweet it, it makes me look smart. So it's almost like a you have to get them bought into, like, this is what this aligns with who I am almost as a person.
Sure.
And then that's why I will laugh. That's why I will respond. Is that fair to say?
Yes. It's also like finding ways to make them put the pieces together. So like laying out things in such a way that someone who's watching is able to go like, hey, I see that A and B are connected. I figured that out like a genius. And then naturally us on stage or whoever's telling the story will be able to go like, did you know A and B are connected? And then the audience gets to feel smart and clap. And that's all that anyone really wants. And I agree, like when it comes to like how we present ourselves in life and especially on social media, it's really easy to want to show off the smartest part of yourself just by reflecting the things that you see around ourselves. The trick too is like being able to recognize those moments when you want to present yourself as like, I'm a genius, I'm super smart. And also like, here's how I reach that conclusion and spell it out for others. So hopefully they can figure out how to feel smart too.
Yes. Pass the smartness forward. Pass it around. Cleverness. Yes. You've done a lot of improv productions. Can you tell me about book club? Like, what is book club in quotation marks? And how is it not a book club? That's my assumption.
I'm so happy you're asking about Book Club. Book Club is a duo that I've had with Amalia Larson for the last, holy shit, 6 or 7 years. So Book Club is an unscripted theater production, is how we usually describe it, because when you watch it, it feels more like a play than it does like a comedy show. But the premise of it is that two really horrible, annoying, rich white ladies from Bellevue, if you live in Seattle, you'll get the joke, have a monthly book club that they host. And every week, they are the only two people that show up. One of the fun parts of book club is that we always have wine on stage and the show always turns into a low key, like who can chug the most wine on stage contest. We have a good time with it. It's
hashtag
a lot of
too real. Yeah,
it's very real. But at the start of every show, we ask the audience for a book. Any book. And so they'll hand a book and we pretend that we've read it and we try to relate our shallow lives to whatever is in that book that we have.
Okay.
So in the early days of doing the show, we would be slugging back wine and reading like very goofy, like very silly books. Like someone would bring in Starship Troopers or like a children's book and we very seriously pretend to have read it. And then, like, after a few years of doing this, the audience figured out that if they brought serious books, the show was a lot more interesting. It started when someone brought in a book about homelessness. And so we got to play these two awful, awful ladies, like, thinking about what it would mean to not have a home for the very first time. And it was so much fun as a performer to be able to like watch this character go through this journey in real time while also slugging back a ton of wine at the same time. But that trick of beginning from a place of comedy and then just like careening into tragedy is one of my favorite devices. It's so much fun. And after that show, everyone started to bring like really depressing books for us to read so that we could have that same thing of these two awful ladies thinking about these issues for the first time, which was, it was really fun.
So that becomes the conceit. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. What happens if it really is a book that you've not read or either of you have read? Do you just base it on the book cover or the title and just, or do you ask the audience to give kind of a summary of it, like how interactive
never.
Is it?
No, we go in blind. We read the back cover and we read the title and then just like go off of vibes and pretend that we know this book inside and out.
And pretend you've read it.
Okay. Exactly. And so that makes for those moments of magic, right? When we'll say to each other, like, you know, this reminds me of a really moving passage on page 45. And we'll go to page 45 and it's either like not remotely moving at all.
Right. And then you'll still read whatever's on page 45.
And then go, oh my God, this means everything to me. Exactly. Or you get to page 45 and like it's suddenly relevant and like way too connected to what we were just talking about. And that's the beauty of improv, is you never know what's going to happen or what the next like step in the story is going to be.
So how do you go from a lifetime of being involved in improv to working in the games industry? Tell me how this happened.
So when I graduated, me and my friends formed a theater company here in Seattle, and we were really proud of it. We did a lot of fun work, and I was doing improv on the side, and I was convinced that my life was going to be making alienating art in the evenings, and then my day job was just going to be really really crappy social media jobs, and that's my life, and that's perfect. I was really ready for that to be it. And
You're a
after
realist.
I
Okay.
am, yeah. I was really okay with that. And after 2 years of making art in the evenings and really crappy social media stuff during the day, I got a job at Wizards of the Coast as community manager for Magic Online in 2014.
Don't
And that
shortcut this. You gotta let me know, like, looking back, how'd you get this gig? Like, there must have been something you did with crappy social media that impressed somebody.
Yes, I spent some time. So right after I graduated from college, I worked at Eikenhez Cheeseburger. I don't know if you remember that website. Someone listening to this will. It was a horrible meme website, and I worked on it for a while. And so that was on my resume. Trick Jarrett was the guy who hired me. He saw that I had done comedy, and I had done like this as a former job, and that was the leg up I had. So I got the job, even though I had played Magic three times before getting that
Okay.
job. So it was a steep learning
So Trick
curve.
interviewed you and that was it. Like you got the
That's
role.
it. Yeah, exactly. I joined the team, and immediately realized that I was in over my head and called all of my friends who played Magic, begging for them to help me. Please, this is Magic Online. It's the big one. I need to learn how to do this well. So yeah, with the help of some friends, I was able to get caught up to speed.
Okay. And let's get into it. Like, what was your time at Wizards of the Coast like, and what were the kind of different things that you did?
Oh my God. Oh, that's a huge question. So I spent 8.5, nearly 9 years at Wizards.
Okay, so you probably lost count of the projects you worked on, but.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's just like a smear of cardboard at this point. Yeah.
Right.
Within the first couple of months of working in community management, I learned that there were other people in the building who were paid money to write stories about elves and dragons and stuff. And I said to myself, well, I can do that. I've been doing that for years. And because of my company and because of my
On the
background,
stage.
I had a
Yeah.
portfolio ready to go. So I went to Jenna Helland, who was the lead of creative at the time on the world building team. And I asked, would it be possible to write an ancillary story? Doesn't need to be a big one, just on the side. I would love to give it a shot. And she asked for some samples and said, yeah, we'll take a shot on you. Absolutely. And so she let me write a story. The first one was, ooh, it was for a Commander release, and I was writing about Tasa Karlov, and it was a blast. I had so much fun, and people didn't like hate it or tell me that I was horrible. So I figured, well, I should probably keep doing this. And so after a few more years of doing community management, I was able to move over full time to the world building team. And that's where I spent a good chunk of my time at Wizards.
So before you officially moved over to the world building team, you had already been writing ancillary or other types of stories for Magic, is that right?
I had written, I think, like two or three while I was over on the community team, and also just like finding opportunities to just like make fun story stuff for myself. I don't know if anyone who's listening remembers the Hanweir Chronicle. We did this like ARG where we sent a bunch of like handwritten letters that were written by me from the perspective of someone living in Innistrad, and we mailed them out to a bunch of different content creators, and it was a really fun project, and culminated in revealing the Hanweir card that has like the horrible town that's made up of everyone who lives inside of it. So projects like that were really fun. I am insane, and I can't not make work for myself. So I did that kind of stuff a lot. But yeah, and then when I did manage to move over to the world building team, initially it was as a member of the central like writing team. It was going to be me and two other people. But over the course of a couple of months, they went to different projects, and it was just me. And that's when Ixalan happened.
And that's when we got Jace alone and some of the stuff that happened from
The entire Ixalan block, except for one story, which was written by Kelly Diggs, was me, kind of on my lonesome. So it was difficult and lonely, but also really enriching and fun at the same time. Being able to have agency over like helping to make the best story possible with these characters that I was given.
That's something that totally fascinates me as someone who does not work for Magic or did not work for Magic is, or maybe let me break it down. Like when you first started writing the first piece, like for Taysa, how much guidance were you given? Like, is it like an artist, you know, when you're asked to do a piece of art, like, okay, here's the file, the dossier on this character and they have to look like this. And then are you getting like a creative version of that? Like it has to be like within these parameters, or how do you even start writing a story in the Magic universe?
It has changed a lot. So we'll kind of go in order of the work that I've done. With that like very, very first story, the prompt that I had was, here's the card from the Commander deck.
Oh, that's it. So it's just literally like a name and a visual, literally.
It really was, yeah. So we know that that Grandfather Karlov is going to be the card. What story do you want to put around it? And I was a baby, and so I was terrified and didn't know, like, how do you start when there's just, like, a blank page? But I gave it some thought and, like, thought back to the work that I'd read before in Magic's, like, story and lore. And Taysa's always been one of my favorite characters. She's a blast to write. I love everything about her. And so finding a way to, like, okay, yes, Grandfather is the card, but also, like, let's talk about his granddaughter and what the relationship is like. And so that's how I kind of, like, found that connection and thread to begin from somewhere. And this also kind of ties back to improv. How do you start when there's nothing there? Is you start from like, what's the one thread that you can see? And then you go, okay, cool. Let's play the association game of like, what's associated with this thread that I can follow and chase until I find the idea where I'm like, yeah, that sounds fun. So that's kind of how you start when there's nothing there. For Ixalan, that was a really unique case in that the story cards had already been designed and established, and the art was finished by the time that I got on board. So I had, I think it was like 7 or 8 like story cards in a specific order with specific names and specific art. And so all of
like
that...
Like Jace has amnesia, like that's already...
So okay. All of that had to be true, but the connections of how we get to one and the other... there it was just kind of left open. So that was a really fun, like, it was kind of like writing a jukebox musical, like those kind of musicals where it's like, it's all ABBA music, or like, whoa, it's all Elvis. And they try and make a story happen in between all of those songs, and even though the songs are set. It was kind of like that. And so figuring out like what is the most exciting story that we can tell within these parameters was how we would do it. The way it works nowadays is they have a fantastic team who comes up with the story before bringing on the writers. And so for the epilogues that I wrote, I got a fantastic outline of here's the things that we want to see happen. It fits on one page. There's lots of different stuff going on. It's a very clear jumping off point. So it's been kind of cool to watch over the years how more context is given, which is great, as Magic keeps bringing on new writers and expanding what it does. Providing that context gives a leg up that someone who doesn't know Magic like I do wouldn't really have. They wouldn't be able to go like, okay, so the card is Grandfather Karlov. That means that I can do this and I can do this and I can do this. Someone coming in fresh doesn't have that. So that context is great.
Interesting. So it's almost like the system now is a form of like scalability or kind of safeguard so that anyone can get more hands-on and ready to go writing something, because like the outline is there, or the broad strokes are there.
Exactly. You don't need to have 9 years of Magic lore knowledge lodged in your brain in order to tell a good story, which is great, because that means that we can reach out to so many different writers, which only makes the brand better.
But how about for you? Like, wouldn't you prefer going always being in that kind of like, here's the grandfather and that's it? Like,
Ooh.
given your background, I'm not saying in general.
Oh, there's always a way. I at least with the epilogues especially, there's always a way to find a chance to really make it your own. There was
That's
one
true.
thing in the outline that was given to me that I saw and I kind of like looked at and was like, I think it would be better if he went to his mom's house. And seeing Roy just go like, oh my gosh, yes, we want to see Jace's mom. And I was like, okay, great, we'll do that. So like every creative conversation is a conversation.
Okay,
Like
it's
it's
still a back
about
and forth.
we're all working together to find the best story possible, which is also very improv. Yeah.
That is super interesting. Now, do you think that that landed because of your credentials, or do you think any writer, like, I'm not saying, like, hey, I'm Alison Lures, I'm amazing, but like, you are,
Thanks.
can I assume that's because of your past, like, portfolio that, you have maybe have a little bit more sway in that?
I mean, yeah, I was inside the house for a long time. But also I'm definitely not going to assume anything. I think best idea wins, and I'm pretty certain that the team inside thinks the same thing too. It doesn't matter where an idea comes from. If it's powerful, then that deserves being warranted.
Okay. So going back to the middle, like Ixalan, you
Yeah.
mentioned that it was before the full outline creative process of stories, but and also at the time you said that you were a one person show at one point because others had transitioned or whatnot. So that was a pretty unique situation, right? Because
Yeah.
then I assume that maybe to make this a general question, like how
Sure.
does it work when you're in a stable with other writers? Is it like writing for a TV show where it's like you have to be in a
Oh.
writer's room and you have to like hash it out? Or is there like an editor or like a boss that generally helps like make the calls?
The answer to all of those is yes, depending on the situation. A good example might be Amonkhet, which was a set right before Ixalan happened, and that was when Michael Ichow was still on the writing team with me. So he and I were kind of like tag teaming, along with some other folks, figuring out how do we break the story, how do we make it all make sense together. We outlined everything. We got to take over a whiteboard and do that traditional process. At the time, there wasn't an editor, so it was just kind of like us checking our own work and bringing in other experts from around the company if they knew something we didn't. But ultimately, everything would need to be approved by whoever was over us at the time. So we would need to send everything in and get it approved that way.
Okay. So, I mean, were you surprised at all by the super positive reception to your writing for Ixalan? Like,
I was absolutely floored. And
okay.
I did not anticipate it happening, which is why when those stories were published, my name was not on them. So
Oh.
I asked for my name to be taken off before they went live because I was worried. And this is, man,
Oh.
past me was a dumbass. I was so worried that I would be targeted because I had a feminine name for writing those stories. And I
Oh.
was so it was this was this was back in like
I think
20.
that's a legitimate concern, right? There are
It
authors,
was,
there's
yes.
some examples that come to mind, but we don't need to talk
Yeah.
about it, but like they use
Yeah.
initials or they have a pen name and things like
Yeah,
that.
exactly. And remember, like this was back in like 2015, like 2016, 2017. Like it was just after Gamergate, and things were really, really frightening. And I let my fear get the better of me. And so instead of like owning all of that work that I did, I asked for our editors, like please just like please use a like Magic Team wrote this instead of just me. If there's one choice I made at Wizards, I wish I could change, it's that. But after a while, and after I realized, like, Allison, that was a really stupid decision. And you're braver than that. You're much braver than that. And so I went back and I asked them to fix it. And so over the years, people began to forget that the Magic Story Team name ever happened. And I'm proud to be associated with those stories. I'm proud of what they did. I'm proud of the response to them. But boy, I never saw it coming.
Yeah, And this is where I have to get honest. Like, you know, I think, okay, I'll be really honest. Like, when I interviewing someone like you or an artist or a creative person or even like Michelle Rapp, like a few months ago, it's a little bit outside of my wheelhouse because I'm not a huge follower of magic lore
That's okay.
and backstory. And I feel like, okay, so first of all, maybe a little thing you should know about me is that I like to both sides or multi-sides almost everything. So I always feel like when it comes to arguments, we should be very nuanced about it, that we shouldn't go to like absolute statements like this is great or this is trash. It feels like sometimes in the world, we tend to put things into these polar opposites.
Completely
And
agree.
I totally get it, you know. It's shorthand. It helps us understand things faster. We don't have a lot of time to get everything, so sometimes we develop these funky heuristics. But something that there's two things that happened to me. Like number one, I was always more of a spike. Like when it comes to magic, like I don't want to say I'm the kind of person that says things like, oh, you know, you could have no art and like no names, and I would still play magic. I know there's people like that
Oh, they're
honestly
super
believe
art.
that.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not quite there. But on the other hand, I do care more about like the card's function, like for competitive play,
Which is
than
fine.
the flavor, right? Also, you know, spoiler alert, I'm not a commander player. You know, I know
Yes.
it's sacrilege to say this, but on the other hand,
Disgusting.
I know. So I know. How dare
You
I?
are in a safe, we're safe here. You're okay.
The
It's
safe space,
be
right?
who
Okay.
you are. Yes.
Okay. So I guess one thing has always been more competitive minded, and then I've also never followed the story super closely. But then it's a combination of that, and then you always hear people dunk on magic stories. So it's like for me, magic stories always been kind of a homogenous blob. Like I don't pay a lot of attention to who the writers are and who the creative teams are and things like that. And it's not a very smart thing to say in retrospect, because obviously people do the
Oh
things that
yeah.
go
Oh
well.
yeah.
So it's kind of like saying I like magic cards, but I don't care about how they're designed and things like that, you
Yeah.
know?
You know, I would say to that how lucky you are that there are so many things for you to discover still. There's so many
You are a nice
opportunities and so
person.
many
I
things.
like
Yeah.
that.
No, human existence is so small, and we only get to see like the little sliver of things in front of us. How lucky that you are in a hobby that is so deep and so wide that it has so many different parts to go explore.
I guess to finish my thought, like I what and this is very I'm already sounding very incoherent, I can tell in my head, but what I'm saying is that like the polarized nature of the world makes it so that there are generalizations like, you know, magic storyline is not good. And then but then I feel like that needs to be more nuanced as I'm learning, because like there's always slivers of good and not good in
Yes,
everything.
of course.
So I feel like as a writer, you must be able to find like the spaces where you can still, maybe going back to what you're saying a little bit ago, a while ago, like you can still evoke emotional responses and get people to feel something,
Oh
even
yeah.
though at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's Jason Vraska
Oh
and
yeah.
these superhero planeswalkers, right?
Why do you think I was so excited to write about Chase in the first place? I went into Ixalan knowing that this is Magic's most despised character. And the thing that I wanted to like promise to myself is I'm gonna make them love him. I am going to write this guy as such a person that he is in like unquestionably interesting. And like that was my target. That was my goal. I'd spent years as a community manager for Magic. Like I know what people say. I know what they talk about. And that just made my fire burn harder of just like, yeah, I bet I can make you like him. And that was the goal.
How do you think you I feel like this must have been even before Magic, but like this sort of wanting to almost prove people wrong or have a chip on your shoulder, like where do you think that comes from?
Oh
Is it
God.
improv or even before?
No. It's before then. I yeah, no. I always kind of grew up an underdog. Like it's that attitude of just like, you know what, I can go out and I can prove it is something that is ingrained in who I am. I have no idea where it came from. Maybe my dad, like maybe growing up in Pasco, but like that sense of just like, no, I can prove it, so I'm gonna, is something that's just, it's part of who I am. And that extends into the work that I make, the kinds of projects I take on, the absurd undertaking of like, I'm gonna take magic's most controversial character and make people like him. Yeah, I'm gonna do it. Let's go.
Something I also noticed is that in your writing process, like you had mentioned, like, okay, I started working at Wizards of the Coast. You know, I don't really know too deeply about Magic the Gathering. So let me go and find out and ask friends and get more involved. And I understand later on, like in your writing, you also do a ton of research. So can you tell me about that process of like, I guess it's like two parts. One is the mindset of wanting to do research, because I feel like not everyone is of that mindset. But then also secondly, like, what is your research process like? Because you strike me as someone from your work that actually puts a lot of time into doing this and involving people around you to help you better understand the stories you're trying to tell.
I do. It's the most important part in my mind. It's impossible to create something without a foundation underneath it. Whenever I think of research, I think of trying to find things that either directly relate to what I'm making, if it's a set that takes place somewhere, or if it's a story that draws from other parts of our real world. Obviously, I want to spend and sink time into understanding that and getting better, but also finding like, what are the things that are tangentially connected to this that may not be obvious at first, but have a really important hook that I can hold on to. To me, research is the thing that turns a story from just existing on the surface to having some depth beneath it, because it has that foundation of understanding.
Can you give me an example of what you said about how like maybe there's things that are tangentially related, but they end up having quite an impact on your creative output?
Yeah. Ixalan's probably still the easiest. Ixalan is built on two different tropes. The trope of like the amnesiac, like losing my memory, and like, you know, all the stories that can spill out of that. But it's also an enemies to lovers story. So all of the different kinds of stories of two people who despise each other who end up being drawn together in the end. So finding those kinds of targets, those other stories, understanding the shape of them, and being able to weave that back into the thing that I'm making. Tropes are shorthand. Like, they're just kind of a cheat code to convey a lot of information in a very short period of time. Humans think in tropes. Sometimes it's really happy and sometimes it's really harmful. But it's a part of being human. So it's a tool that we should use as storytellers.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking of things like, you know, the hero's journey, or like just even there being conflict in stories, period.
Yeah,
like, are those tropes, or are they, would you label them something else?
Hero's journey is absolutely a trope. So that's like a story shape, like a structure that you can use. We can think of it like scaffolding. There are certain beats that you hit in order, and that's kind of how that works. But like general conflict, I would say that is... when you're mixing music, there's different like tones and levers that you can pull, right? Conflict's kind of one of those. You can dial it up to make things a little bit more spicy and interesting, or you can cool it down when you need people to connect. So it's a lever that you can adjust inside of a story in order to convey information.
So it's a constant, almost like gravity. And then you just decide to what degree it's there, but it's always there, right?
Yeah, stories don't exist without conflict. Otherwise, it's just a situation.
Right. All right, this is a weird question to follow up with, but
hit me.
What would you say to someone like, you know, James from 10 years ago that just has an absolutely negative view of the Magic storyline and thinks it's not worth paying attention to?
I would look very sweetly and also say at the same time, maybe you should try reading it first. There's lots of different corners, and like what's cool about Magic's story is that there's a little bit of everything depending on what vibe you're looking for. Like, if you're looking for an epic fantasy, we got that. If you're looking for quiet and weird, we have that too. There's lots of different corners because it's decades old and there's so much stuff crammed in there. There's a starting point for everybody. If you're interested, then you can just give it a shot. And if you don't like it, you don't gotta read it.
Okay, Yeah, I feel like that's a bit of an unfair question because some people are big fans of the storyline. I guess it just depends on what part of the internet you ask. So.
Exactly. Yeah, my corner's pretty nice. They're pretty friendly.
is there like a kind of a starter kit for like someone who's been playing Magic for a couple of years and wants to know more about the backstory? Do they just start reading from the stuff around the current set, or is there a sort of like almost like a Star Wars, like, okay, there's a recommended watch order or something like that?
Yeah, I think beginning from Magic Origins is probably the best way to like get that foundation of who these central characters are. From there, there's a handful of stories that are really helpful here and there to build on that. But once you like kind of know who everybody is, what their objectives is, what their damage is, then it's pretty fun to just sort of go do your own thing. In the later stories, especially now, the lore is pretty dense, so there's a lot of catching up to do. But also, there's plenty of resources online to help make that easier. I'm making sure I am referencing this correctly. Yes, mtglore.com is a fantastic resource if you want to get into the story. It's run by fans. There's lots of resources on there, some great guides on where to start. And that's a great way to get involved in not just the story, but the community that comes with it, because there's a lot of great folks.
Okay, so this is the Magic version of Lostpedia?
Pretty much, yes. Oh my God, you're a Lost fan too!
Hey, I did my research too. So.
That's great.
We can get into that later. Maybe we spin off a 5-hour podcast on Lost.
On just James and Allison talk about Lost. Yes. Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
Episode one. Yeah. Going back to the storytelling, you've been known to involve friends in your writing process. Can you give me a few examples of that? And maybe even before that, just why you do it? Like, you just, obviously, the one reason is like you just strike me as an incredibly outgoing social person, so maybe that's a part of it, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Like I said, with why I do improv rather than stand up, I fall apart if I can't talk to people, so being able to involve others and go to them, because someone else's brain will always have an idea that mine won't. Someone else is always going to be able to spot something that I can't see. So being able to like start that brainstorming process with another person, or have them read through a draft or two of mine, or even just like be there so I can talk at them and make sure a story makes sense. Writing can be really isolating. It is a lonely activity. And so I love trying to find ways to fight that and combat that and bring others to help not only support me, but also make my shit better. I will never be able to have the great ideas that my friends do. So I would much rather have an expert that I can go talk to. And those experts are the people around me.
So you must have lots of examples to draw from, but just give me one or two, like, where your friends were, because it sounds like almost every endeavor you're trying to involve them in some way, right?
Yes, I like the people around me. First one, it's probably the first story I worked for Magic. I grabbed my friend Austin while we were on a lake cabin party, and we were out on the boats, and I paddled my boat up next to him, and I was like, hey, so I have to write this story for work and it needs to be good and I'm really scared. What do you think are some ideas that I should start with? And we jammed it out on the boat, and by the time I paddled all the way back, I knew what I was going to do and where I was going to start. In the years after, I have pulled so many friends into like, hey, can you tell me why your favorite movie is this specific genre I'm about to write about? Or like, hey, I need to study time travel for a time travel project that we're going to do. I looped my friend Anna once into a weekend of watching time travel movies, and she suffered through me keeping like a chart of like how time travel works in each of these movies. And so I appreciate that my friends are game to get down for these horrible research projects.
Oh, gosh. So you must have watched all the sci-fi classics.
Oh, I watched them. Travel. Oh, my. Oh, the Time Travel Weekend. I watched them all. It was like seven of them in increasing levels of just like complexity and nonsense. Looper's still my favorite. I think that has the cleanest time travel system, in that it deliberately doesn't answer anything, which is great.
Yeah, the Star Trek kind of time travel is always a little a little off
it's
to me.
It's a mess.
But...
And then you get to like Bill and Ted's and it's just like a mess. It's a disaster.
Who can forget Bill and Ted? Yeah.
I hate time. I really hope I don't
Back
have to,
the to future,
write a time
Bill
travel
and
story.
Yes, yes. So is there something that you might say to people who are considering working in the games industry? Because I got a weird question from a friend. He basically said, ask Allison, not one of your friends, but one of my friends, like he said, ask Allison, like how, this is such a leading question, like ask her, how do you work in the game? How can you work in the game industry without burning out and still finding your spark? So I feel like a better way to ask that might
be
like,
that's a real question though.
How do you, okay, so that's a real question.
Yes.
But so maybe let's make it a two-parter. Like, how do you, like, what would you recommend for someone that's getting started? And then once you're in, how do you prevent yourself from burning out? Like, what's your experience?
It's the same answer for both. And it's something that I tell my team a lot, which is that doing creative work, it's really tempting and really easy to put your whole heart into it. Like to put all of you into the thing that you're making, because that's what writers do. That's what artists do. It's very natural. And also it's the thing that is most dangerous when making something for so many people that so many folks will see, where anything can happen once you send it out into the world. And so the advice that I give is finding a way to protect your heart when you're making something for a job this big. Like, make sure that when you're working on something, you aren't putting your entire self and your entire soul on top of this thing. Because if someone critiques it, then they're critiquing you. But if you're able to protect like that little bit and learn to give like just enough that you're not also giving yourself up, that allows you to protect that little part and keep it alive. For me, something that's been really helpful has been having a hobby outside of work that isn't games and also doesn't use the same part of my brain that I use during the day. For the roughest years of being in this industry, honestly, improv was a savior. Like being able to do something out of work that didn't involve games, that used a different part of my brain, that still allowed me to be creative, and that just belonged to me. Like no one else owned that. It was all mine. That allowed me to keep going, whereas if I didn't have that, I probably would have burnt out many times by now. But yeah, like that, being able to protect yourself is the hardest part of working in the game industry for me.
Would you say that's a kind of developed emotional detachment? Almost like, maybe not emotional detachment because we're not cold hard machines, but just
it kind of is.
just creating a little bit of distance.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's a skill that just comes with time again. Like and it's the same thing as improv too, right? Of just like doing something enough that you are being constantly critiqued and you're constantly failing, but being able to like take a step back and recognize that I'm not the thing that I make. Like the thing that I present and the thing that I am writing, the thing that I drew, that isn't me. And that allows you to take feedback. That allows you to take critique. And that allows for feedback to turn from a like moral failure into a gift that tells you how to make something better. And so learning to embrace that feedback is a gift, that failure is a gift. All of those are tools that we can use to make ourselves better and to make our work better for somebody else while protecting your heart at the same time.
You got to tell me how to do that. even when I'm doing like little things interview episodes, like I can get defensive when I get a negative thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I feel like if you work for Magic or even like a major gaming studio in general, like you're just getting like a deluge of feedback. So
all the time. Absolutely. And
how do you develop that resilience to taking it?
You know, weirdly, it was, for me at least, it was working on community management, like sifting through Twitter bullshit all day and like reading through Facebook comments all day. You eventually kind of like see through the matrix and realize that like inside of like the horrible comments, there's usually like a nugget of like actual feedback of like, hey, I would be happier if you did this.
Right.
And so like realizing that like when someone's giving a critique, 99% of the time it's in good faith. They want you to succeed. They want you to do well. They want
otherwise, they wouldn't even take the time to say something.
And that 1% of the time where it's in bad faith, you can just not listen to that. it just doesn't matter. But like for the good faith times, like being able to sift through opinion and get to the little critique that's actually true underneath, like that's your nugget that you need to actually pay attention to. So the art of like learning how to filter out what is meant in good faith versus what is just bad faith bullshit, because you can just ignore that stuff. That doesn't matter. Right. But it's it just takes time, and also like remembering that humans are messy, and they have a bad time expressing themselves with words most of the time. But most people are acting in good faith and want you to be good. They want you to succeed.
And I really like that answer because it's based on experience. Kind of like the cliche, like how do you deal with rejection? Like become a salesperson and get used to people saying
get rejected
no to
all
your
the
face,
time. Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Given what you've told me so far, I imagine, not to get too dark about it, but like, I imagine it must have been tough for you during COVID, like in terms of not being able to, maybe you could have a Zoom call with someone like this and, you know, you can talk about ideas, but it's not the same as like, you know, going to a cabin or a boat with somebody and like hashing things out, right? So can you describe what your experience was like during those few years?
It was absolutely isolating. It felt awful to have, especially with theater, like to have both my art and my community just evaporate, just gone.
Yeah.
They were both just gone. There was an attempt in the first like couple years of COVID to try and do like, it's Zoom performances.
Like Zoom comedy, right?
It was the cringiest. It was so awful.
Okay.
It was
it didn't
so
work.
Painful. Yeah. It was so
I always
bad.
Wondered if someone out there made it work, like the one in 1,000 people that
Man,
it worked.
If they did, I didn't see it. But yeah, it really stunk losing that part of like, yeah, both community and art at the same time. I felt really lost. The thing that brought me back and made me feel more complete again was reaching out to some of my other like improv lady friends and asking like, hey, do you want to go backpacking? Like, do you want to go outside? Since that's the one thing that we can do, like, let's just go.
Yeah.
And so we started doing some just backpacking trips together. They were both Girl Scouts as a kid, and I had my dad, who was a mountaineer, like an actual like going out in the wilderness kind of dude. And so all of us would just like go out, and it was the most freeing feeling in the world. So we did that a bunch in 2023 or 2022. We took a trip to Alaska for 40 miles in the backcountry of Katmai National Park. It was dope.
Okay. Did your friend Anna go with you or?
No, she didn't. I sent her lots of pictures of bears. Yeah.
Okay. Because just in my research, I talked to Anna and she said that you're a badass wilderness woman. Like you can definitely keep people alive. Based on what you said, I think that corroborates,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Growing up, my dad didn't enlist me in the Girl Scouts because he was like, I can just teach you that. And he did. He's very good at it.
So you know how to make a fire. You know how to
do
the things.
I know how to make several different kinds of fire. I know how to find
water. Wait, there's different kinds of fire? I didn't even know.
Well, different like constructions of like a fire. Like you can either do like a little like teepee shape. That's good for like marshmallows and like light. If you want to cook something, you build it in a different shape. There's a lot. But yeah, I love outside. And in the years before I became a theater kid in high school, that was what we did. We were outside people. And I think I convinced myself that I wasn't when I got into theater and when I got into college and when I got into games. But it felt really wonderful to rediscover that part of myself.
That's so interesting, I think, is that we always, not always, but I feel like there's a tendency, maybe it's just like the internet or something, like to put ourselves into a box, like, okay, I'm Allison or I'm James and I am this. But just, I feel like there's so many things going on, right? Like you can be a writer, you can be an improv, you can be a badass wilderness woman. Like you can do a lot of different things, right? Or before you were an athlete, before you had the back problems.
And
you know?
And same as earlier, there's so many corners of magic and there's so many corners of the world. Why not just take a dabble and experience them? Allison, why shouldn't I sign up for a super spiky tournament? Maybe I should.
Take a break from Commander.
Step out of your comfort zone. Get your ass kicked. It's going to be great. Yeah.
Yeah. At least you can say, hey, I, you know, I had something to do with that card or that story, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And then I'll die immediately. And it'll be a great story after that. So that's not
all
so
right.
bad.
I'm going to risk opening Pandora's box.
Okay.
How realistic were the depictions of survival in Lost?
Man, everyone sure shaved their armpits and
and Hurley never lost weight. And like,
they all seem pretty dang comfy. They had a lot of like explanations for that of like, oh, they found lots of food.
I'm not even talking about grooming. I'm talking about like, you know, how they make fires or like how they decide to go for shelter somewhere versus another.
That was pretty accurate. I appreciated that they started with we need to build a shelter because that is the most important part. Like you need to set up where you're going to be.
Okay, so they did some research on that at least.
They did a little bit. I appreciate too that there was like varying levels of success of wilderness survival. Like you had Locke who knew exactly what he was doing and he was the first person to like set up your thing and then go find water, which is what you're supposed to do, all the way down to like Sawyer reading books in his doofy little shelter. It's great. I love Lost. I will be a Lost apologist till the day I die.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, I will say, you know, I feel like people say a lot of things about Lost, just like they say a lot of things about the Magic storyline. But I will take this to my grave. Like, the first and second seasons of Lost are, like, among the greatest seasons of television I have ever watched. Probably the first season is, like, I remember, because I didn't watch it in primetime, I watched it on DVD.
Yeah.
You know, that was the era where, like, you discover a lot of things on DVDs, yes, right? Yeah, shows and movies. It was great. And now we have streaming. But, like, I remember just being, like, absolutely, like, my jaw just dropped, like, when they started doing the flashbacks. I was just like, holy crap. Like, I have never experienced this on television, you know? And this is coming from someone who watched, like, you know, a lot of, like, X-Files in the 90s and, like, a lot of different shows, like, as growing up in the 90s and 2000s, you know? And it's just... It was out there.
Lost pulled so many tricks for the first time, and it was absolutely entrancing. They were so brave to do as many just shenanigans as they did, and sometimes it was great, and sometimes they absolutely whiffed it. When I describe Lost to other people, I don't say it's a good show, but it is a show that you will never forget. Like the highs are so high. The lows are so low. It's a great balance. That's exactly it.
So I'm just gonna say like depends on preference, but like the highs just make up for any shortcomings.
I totally agree.
Swing and a miss, you know.
Yep, I will tolerate the guitar case with a giant ankh inside of it because you know what? I got that pilot.
Or I got that episode with the time travel one, right?
Oh, like the Constant. I watch the Constant. It every Christmas. It's so good. I love that show.
Yeah. Honestly, like I don't rewatch a lot
do
of
this podcast, dude.
I don't rewatch a lot of shows, but like I've only watched The Constant once, and this is 2024 we're talking about. I can still remember that. Or like the first reveal that you know, I think the guy is it Devin? I
can't remember his name.
Desmond. When you first find out he's in the hatch, right? Like,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't think my memory is that good, but like only watching these episodes once, like, I still remember this like decades later. You know?
Yeah. The first paragraph of Ixalan is a Lost reference. That one's just for you. There you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. He wakes up surrounded by bamboo instead of Vincent the Labrador. It's an Oviraptor. So there you go.
When you write the magic stories, is there a lot of oversight? Like, does someone have to like edit or sign off on the things that you do in general? There's got to be some safeguards, right?
Yes. So for the epilogues, I started from that awesome outline, and I was sending in regular drafts to Roy, who's the current story lead. Those are also shared with whoever the creative lead on world building is, as well as sometimes like additional editors for eyes. So, and also Jay, the official historian for Magic as well. So it's a whole crew of people who are reading those things.
Okay, so you get notes and you get feedback on. Okay.
It's nice, yeah.
Right on. Switching gears a little bit, like from talking to your friend Ichal, like he mentioned that you were the one who pulled him into a job at Wizards of the Coast. Like, can you tell me about
Twice.
That?
Yeah.
Twice. Okay, tell me about it.
Oh, I did it twice. Yeah. So I met Ichal through improv, and he had a fantastic writing background. We were both in the same tournament, but in different years. I was volunteering and he was participating. And we became buddies. I learned through the grapevine that he liked magic, and so we connected over that. And he mentioned that he had some experience with like doing more professional writing. I knew that we were hiring a community manager at the time. I was still on the community management team. And so while he was in town, I was driving him, I think, to his hotel or something in downtown Seattle. And I got a message from Trick Jarrett, my boss at the time, saying like, hey, can you bring him in today for an interview? And I asked each out, do you have a nice shirt? And he said, what? And so I just kind of like turned the car around, started driving towards Renton and explained, hey, so we can get you an interview, but also it's only today. Do you have a nicer shirt? And he said, no. And I was like, it's okay. It's Trick. I think we're going to be all right. Yeah. And so I brought him back to the office and he went in for the interview, like right after landing, and he scored the job. So he moved from LA up to Seattle within like a couple months after that. And after we were both worked together and both ended up back at the same place in Magic Creative, he left to go do another opportunity. And then a few years passed. And at that time, I was in digital publishing at Wizards. Mm-hmm. So I was working more on like digital D&D games, mm-hmm. a couple of like digital magic games. And we had an opening on my team that I would be running. And so I called him up and said, hey, bud. Wanna go for round two, and invited mm-hmm. him to come interview with me. And he did and came back up a second time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I treasure each other's friendship because we have known each other in so many spheres, in so many ways. Every now and then I see like him like chatting with a friend that I've had for 15 years and have to remind myself like, oh yeah, he knows him too. Like, yeah, they all know each other.
Common circles.
Yeah. I really treasure having a strong circle of friends. And the one I've got is real solid. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's a responsibility of ours to provide opportunities for our friends and to help them be the best versions of themselves that they can be. So yeah, I've gotten each out two jobs. I'll get them a third.
So where do you think that comes from? Just kind of looking out for your friends and maybe more than that, just seeing the potential that they have in a role or in a potential role.
Yeah, you know, growing up, my dad and my godfather were best friends of 9,000 years. And our two families had the kind of relationship where you would just show up at each other's house and we're always invited in and we're always invited for dinner. Like, you just kind of easily flow into and out of each other's world. And when I got to college, I met some incredible people, and especially after we all graduated and moved down to Seattle together, I think all of us were very determined to find that second family, that real like base of support. And there were around like six or seven of us that were just super, super close and remained close for decades afterwards. There was a moment at my wedding where my stepsister, who is also my childhood best friend, pulled me aside and she was looking at like the 11 brides folk that I had and asked like, do all of them know each other? And I said, yeah. And she said, do all of them hang out with each other when you're not there? And I said, yes. And she said, that's really rare.
That's uncommon.
That's really special.
Yeah.
And it's true. I am friends with them now and I will be for the next couple of decades. Yeah, I feel really lucky.
Okay. I just feel like even though it's just one interview, like I feel like you have this sort of personality and this way of like being very you that it's nice. It's nice because I feel like there's maybe not a lot of people always that you meet in life that are people tend to be more guarded, I guess, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Life's too short. it really is. Like I would much rather be open about how I'm feeling and what's going on than, you know, try and like put on a face or like pretend that everything's something it's not. Like how am I going to make those 15-year friendships if I'm not open with somebody?
Mm-hmm. I think it also speaks to the friendships you have when like you know somebody from different, like each child is like someone from mm-hmm. improv, also someone that you're like colleagues with eventually, and mm-hmm. like there's some I feel like most of us, when I'm just thinking of my life, like, I don't know, I know a lot of people just on one dimension. You know what I mean? Like, okay, I know this person from work, or I know this person because they're in magic or something. And it's not often the case you get that kind of intersection. Like, is that, I don't know, like, is I guess the question here is, like, how do you develop that? Or is it just being interested in a lot of different things and it just naturally happens?
I think it's being interested in a lot of different things, but more importantly, it's fostering a relationship that lasts. Like treating your friendships as something that is as important as your romantic connections, as your family connections. Because the more that you invest in that relationship, the more that you naturally start inviting them to go do this thing, or taking them to go do this thing, or like, hey, do you want to get our asses kicked at a really spiky tournament? Like being able to do that context switching involves like holding someone's hand and taking them along, or going with them when they go to do something. But all of those relationships like require putting money in the bank. Like you gotta feed them. You gotta prioritize them. Like not just treat it as a like once a month kind of thing.
You got to invest your energy. You got to put yourself out there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's scary, and you're gonna fail until you stop failing.
Talk about the Worlds Collide moment when you guys did an improv show about Magic the Gathering, Kaladesh PAX event. What was that
Oh
about?
man, I
For those
forgot
of us who
about
weren't
that.
there.
Oh my gosh. So there was it was when Kaladesh came out, Magic went just absolutely wild and spent so much money to book the Paramount Theater in Seattle, which is this really beautiful, big,
Amazing
giant
place.
performance space. It's right next door to the convention center, and we had all of it for like playing things. There was a giant merch table and a giant stage, and they had like competitions. It was a blast. But there was a like improv show that was planned at the end of it, because there were like just enough of us in the audience in the office who knew how to do it. So we got to perform on one of the biggest stages in Seattle, doing just like the goofiest set of my life, but also like it was really fun. We were using cards as gets. So like there would be like a card with a name on it, and we would use
Oh,
that
and you
name
riff off of that.
as the inspiration for something. Yeah, it was very fun. But yeah, in terms of like bucket list things of things I should not brag about, but I will. Yes, I performed at the Paramount.
Yes.
Very, very impressive.
I mean, if that stage was booked, you might as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad that we did it. I hope all 15 people who watched it had a great time.
Is there a recording of it somewhere?
Maybe, I don't
Maybe someone
know.
unofficially recorded it. That'd be
You
nice,
know,
fun to dig it up.
there is a well-known fact about improv in that if you record it will look like garbage.
Oh, it loses the magic
It
because
will
it's not
not, it is
live.
the unfunniest shit you've ever seen in your life. Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
So
so it's
just
not going
take,
to make its way to a Netflix special or anything.
probably not, but just take my word for it. It was charming and fun, and yeah, it was a good time.
Awesome. Do you know if that might have been the only Wizards improv event in history?
No, I think we did another one. I can't remember where though. Oh, or what the context was, but I remember me, Icho, and Matt Tabak doing another set somewhere. Maybe I'm making this up, but I remember it happening. And it was the kind of thing where we were like, we should do this again. And then we did do it again, and it was at the Paramount.
Oh, I see. So Paramount was the second time.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
Okay.
but yeah, no. For some reason, at Wizards, there were just a lot of people who knew how to do it. So, yeah. So I guess
Creative types
the
in
Venn
Seattle?
diagram. Yeah,
Yeah, the
it's
Venn
go
diagram.
figure.
Hey, right on. I love that. I love that. I wish I was there. Maybe we'll
was
maybe
fun.
some maybe somebody will make it happen in the
I hope
future. I
so.
don't
Invite me back. Yeah, I'll tell silly magic jokes. Yeah.
You can be a special improv guest, Allison Norris. Okay, I gotta ask you about this. What was it like working on Baldur's Gate 3? Just give
Oh
me
my
the
gosh.
kind of like give me the how you how it started happening and the experience.
Yeah, so after my time on Magic's creative team, I moved over to Wizards Digital Publishing. So that's the team that worked with like licensing partners like Larian, and also publishing new games at the same time internally. So When I got there, I was asked by my boss, Ben Camerano, shout out to Ben, to be the creative lead for Baldur's Gate 3 on the Wizards side. So that means my job was to be the one who would check in with them multiple times a week, provide like feedback on stuff that they sent over, and also to approve officially like marketing materials or anything that our licensing agreement had us need to go over. I was also the person that they would send stuff to for visibility, or if they had questions, it would come to me. So I was working on that game like maybe like 15 to 20% of my time during my bit in publishing, and it was the easiest job in the world because Larian is amazing. So usually, like with publishing or licensing, you're reviewing something and having to send over corrections or suggestions of like, hey, this isn't quite fitting the brand, maybe you should change this thing. But everything Larian sent over was spectacular, and so it was very easy to just be able to give them quick advice of like, yeah, this is great, go for it, don't change a thing. The cool part of that job was that sometimes they would have an idea that would make it into the tabletop game, or the tabletop people would respond to something they were doing and adjust course along the way. So it was really special to be able to like get an idea from our friends at Larian, bring it over to the tabletop team, be like, hey, our buddies in Ghent are going to be doing this thing. An FYI.
So there's like cross activity.
Exactly. Yeah, it was really cool. But yeah, it was really special. I remember the first time that they brought their vertical slice to Wizards for us to see for the first time. And I was sitting at the table and like asking their creative director and their narrative director at the time, so how long is the Golden Path? Like, how long does it take to play through the experience? And they responded like very, very Belgianly, 140 hours. And I was like, my eyes kind of like went wide and my jaw fell a little bit. And I was that's a big game. Wow. Right. Okay. And sure enough, it was 140 hours. They made an incredible, incredible experience.
Yeah. I have to admit, I only played 1 and 2, but I don't remember how long the main thing was in 1 and 2. It feels like this one is longer.
It was a lot shorter. Yes.
Okay. So as the creative lead, or as someone who represents digital publishing Wizards mm-hmm. of the Coast, like, you ultimately have to sign off on what they're doing, right? Like,
yep.
You're saying they did a good job, so it was pretty easy, but you, at the end of the day, you have to say like if something is not mm-hmm. kosher or something is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Fortunately for us, the licensing agreement with Larian gave them a lot of agency and a lot of choice over what they were doing. They didn't have to rely on us to give them the go ahead. It was more of a like, yep, you guys are doing great, you're not breaking the brand, have a fun time. With other projects, yes, it's up to us as publishers to hold the quality bar, to look at what's coming in and assess it fairly, and to work with them to find like, hey, like here's some ways that we can make that idea work in a more D&D way or in a more magic way. My philosophy when working like with a brand or like mm-hmm. an IP is it's my job to ask like whoever we're working with, like, how do you want to do this? Like, what's the approach that you want to take to this? And how can we use our world's rules of like magic or D&D or whatever brand we're working with to make that happen? So I want to enable someone having fun with our sandbox rather than no, you can't do this. 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 Instead, like, let's find a solution with the tools that we have.
Mm-hmm. What was it like doing research for Baldur's Gate 3 as you got involved? Because there seems to be quite an epic amount of things to draw from.
Mm-hmm. D&D is tricky because there is so much depth. Like, it's been around for so long. For me, the important part of like helping them do the best job possible was knowing who to go to or knowing what source to draw from. So it was my job to read up as much as I can on what have we established and what's true and help work with them to find the best answer or give them the freedom to make the right choice. My favorite question that they asked us was, do the Gith lay eggs? It was a fun question. Because we wanted to give them as much room to play as possible. So the answer that I gave them was, what do you think? What's the most interesting thing that they can do? And whatever answer that they were going to give, we would find
that serves the game or the story, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I would much rather have someone make the choice that's best for their game, and we can find a way to justify it using magic, using whatever shenanigans that we have. And fortunately, they've made a choice that aligned both with the original canon and also made for the best choice possible in the game. So whenever I look at the stories that we tell, no matter what studio, no matter what game, the answer should always be what's the most interesting story possible. And then understanding and trusting ourselves to be able to justify it. So that's my approach. If we go into those creative challenges giving ourselves a ceiling of what we can do, then we're only going to play at the ceiling.
Yeah. Hey, they're lucky to have you. Like, knowing this, they're lucky to have you to give them a little bit of creative slack if it serves the the story, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Because I do think there are people out there, maybe just people who edit posts on Wikipedia that maybe are more like into like, okay, this is like very black and white, like it's got to be this way, you know? And
exactly.
And there's nothing, you know, that's a different style. But it's like,
it's totally equal and very valid for some properties. There's other kinds of stories that I'm sure everyone can think of where the rules are very strict from like movie to movie or from TV show to TV show. But there's others where you can find lots of ways to tell a cool story and then justify it in a way that makes sense. Star Trek is the best example of loosey-goosey rules because the rules change all the time. And also,
tell me about it.
And also they're justified all the time. If you build your system in a way where it gives you the freedom to do that, you're going to have a great time.
Mm. What was it like to, you know, be involved in Baldur's Gate 2 and Baldur's Gate 3 and then watching it win all these awards? Like, did the team have a celebration? Like, I don't know. Did you personally celebrate and have champagne or what?
I had left Wizards by the time it happened. And it was kind of like watching my favorite sports team win. Because I was not a player on the sports team. I was just the water gal on the side, like running out to give them water every now and then. But like,
okay, but you still played a part.
Still, yeah, but also like the developers themselves who spent 6 years on this thing, watching them get to go up and like knowing who they are and like knowing them individually, it was so thrilling to watch them get the success that they so deserved. The most that I celebrated was I definitely cracked a beer during the BAFTAs and during the Game Awards and did a little like, I'm in the special thanks, but these guys are great. They fucking killed it. It was really exciting to watch them succeed.
Awesome. Just to kind of wrap things up, are you okay with kind of a lightning round, just like random questions one after another?
Let's go.
Okay. So what is it about the Almighty Johnsons? Like, what is it about this show that attracts you? And for those people like me who don't even know what it is, like, other than the fact it's a comedy drama from New Zealand, like, what is this about and why were you so into it?
It's a comedy show from New Zealand that like 4 people have watched and I'm one of them. And I will never shut up about this show because it's like eating a turkey sandwich. Just like a standard club sandwich, there's nothing too surprising, and there's like a sapphire in the middle, and you're like, well, what the fuck is this sapphire? What is this doing here? That show is that. It is a like very standard like, woo, it's a fun like light fantasy comedy, and then suddenly it's exquisite character drama out of nowhere that makes you think about the state of being alive and a human. It's nuts. It's nuts. I loved it. I rewatch it every now and then, and I've never shut up about it since.
Tell me about, actually, not tell me about, but this is a hypothetical question. If you had to make a 5-course meal for your favorite fictional character, who would it be and what would you make?
Oh my God, that's awful. Let's see. I'm trying to pick someone who would be easy. You know, we were talking about Star Trek, so we're going to go with Captain Kirk. I think he would love a cheeseburger like a really nice one for the main course, starting off with some really nice summer sausage, like a sausage plate, because he's Captain Kirk, and then following up with maybe like a nice like cream of celery soup or something to just like cleanse the palate. And I don't think he would think that was too snooty. For afters, maybe, ooh, we just had a burger, so a really good boozy milkshake for dessert, and then finish off with, I don't know, some kind of space petit fours. I'm assuming they make petit fours in space. I don't know. We'll go with that.
That's a great answer and great pick for character. You're making me want to have a burger and milkshake now for lunch,
really want a
which is
now.
Coming up over
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
It's
maybe,
dinner time
maybe
for
it's
us.
All in our minds. Yeah. yeah, so I understand that you went to Ireland for a friend's wedding once, and you stayed at a kitchen that looked like something out of the Hobbit. So tell me about that whole experience and the dress-up that you folks did.
Our friends, one of the people in our friend group was getting married, and so we all decided to travel out to Ireland to go to the wedding. Because I am me and I can't control myself, I suggested, hey, let's do something wild. What if we stayed in an Airbnb castle? Because there's a lot of those in Ireland, and everyone said like, yes, hell yes, let's do it. So we booked the castle, we got over there, a couple of people brought their favorite like Lord of the Rings like hobbity like costumes to come wear like for a photo shoot, but for the rest of the time all of us were just like in sweatpants chilling, playing music that probably had never been played in a castle before. We had a great big dinner. It was such a magical time, and one of my favorite moments with my community.
Who's your favorite character from the TV show Lost, and why?
That is a real.
This is hard because I know you. It's going to be hard to just list one person, but
really
I'm going to ask you.
Hard. It's oh shit. My gut reaction is Saeed. I think my real answer is probably. It's probably Desmond. No, it's Benjamin. It's Ben Linus. There we go. We got there. Yeah.
You just gave me three names. Okay, let's start with Ben Linus.
We'll go with Ben Linus. I think that's my final answer.
Okay, and why? Why?
What an exquisitely well-written villain. Just a true bastard in every way. Like, there's moments of, like, niceness and interesting, like, oh, you are a deep character. And then he just goes, joke's on you. I'm still the worst. And it's a great balance. Yeah, I love watching him just be the absolute worst human being that's never lived.
There's another show that you're really into, and I believe you're an expert on. Tell me why you were so into Supernatural.
Supernatural also suffers from the turkey sandwich with a sapphire in the middle situation.
Yes.
It is delicious. Like, yep, this is your Monster of the Week show. It's a lot of fun. The two leads look like underwear models. That's a lot of fun, too. And then you bite into it, and you're like, what the hell? Why is this really, really, really high-quality story inside of this, of all things? I love Supernatural. It is the best show to have on in the background, not paying active attention to.
Second monitor thing.
Until the good parts. Exactly. I wrote up a guide a long time ago. If anyone wants it, hit me up. If you want to get into a show that has 15 seasons for some goddamn reason. Yeah.
Yeah.
There is no defense. I know I have committed a TV show crime, but
yeah.
Yeah. I am who I am. What can I say?
Right, right. Don't apologize for that. knowing now what you have studied for time travel, this question will be less cringe. If you could go back in time and tell young Allison Lures from 10 years ago something, what would you tell her?
10 years ago from 2024 was 2014, which was when Gamergate was happening. And young Allison was a community manager. And it was very difficult. I would tell her that those bastards can't make you quit. That's my very serious answer.
Stay strong, stay the course.
No, just like they can't kick you out. They won't make you leave.
They don't have that power.
Nope.
Just don't give in to that.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, those were all my questions. Allison, thank you so much for taking the time today.
James, this was a delight. Thank you so much for having me. And it was great to get to know you too. Thank you.